This is Doug Kay from the Conversations Network, and today it's my pleasure to bring you another edition of Tech Nation with Dr. Moira Gunn. By becoming a paid member, you'll help keep the nonprofit Conversations Network on the air, and you'll have access to our premium edition programs without promotional messages. Just click on the Join button on our website to learn more. SpokenWord.org is our new site with over 70,000 free audiobooks, lectures, speeches, podcasts, and more in both audio and video formats. And it's a great way to manage all of your podcast subscriptions, so come by and take a look at SpokenWord.org. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. And now, here's the host of Tech Nation, Dr. Moira Gunn.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, I'll speak with Zach Shore about the nature of blenders and what we might expect from them.
Hello, I'm Jason Ponton, the editor-in-chief of Technology Review, MIT's magazine that focuses on the future of technology. We're proud to underwrite Tech Nation. Our daily website features cutting-edge tech news, insightful blogs, and original videos every day at technologyreview.com.
Zachary Shore's latest book is Blunder: Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions. He opens up with the blunder of the most famous American inventor of all times, Thomas Alva Edison.
His blunder was static cling.
Oh, no. I thought that wasn't invented till after television.
You would think. But no. It's a term I use to describe someone who cannot recognize a fundamental shift in the environment around him. People who just cling to the idea that things will always remain as they've always been. And it's a fascinating story about the battle of the currents, AC versus DC, and how Thomas Edison had a chance to switch over to alternating current and power his light bulbs and gigantic machines with AC. But he was wedded to direct current and only wanted to use that. And so he rejected this new and superior technology of alternating current. And as a result, he allowed his rival, Nikola Tesla, to eclipse him.
Of course, it was not only his rival, it was his employee.
It was. And he dismissed Tesla. Literally, he caused him to leave the company. And Tesla went on to patent his device and be backed by Westinghouse, and they made a fortune out of it.
Now, we are talking about blunders, but you make a distinction between a blunder, just a simple mistake, and what you call a cognition trap. Let's talk about that.
Okay, let me set that up. So just to define our terms at the start, I think of a mistake as just an error, a simple error. Say maybe you have misinformation. This can happen to anyone. But I define a blunder differently, as a solution to a problem that makes matters worse than before you began. And then I look at something called cognition traps, which are the rigid mindsets we all fall into, rigid ways of approaching and solving problems. And so in the book, I give a different chapter for each cognition trap or rigid mindset. I label them, and then I offer historical and contemporary examples of how people fell into these cognition traps and how those led to blunders.
Then to reinforcing failure.
Exactly.
Because once you make the blunder, you can't really go back.
Exactly.
On this show, of course, I'm all over infomania, the obsessive relationship to information. Tell us about that.
That's a great one. And it's funny you latched onto that, because when I give talks about this book, it's the one that most people seem to locate on first. Infomania is a way that undermines us because we tend to get obsessed with controlling the information flow. And I say that there are two types of infomaniacs. First, the infomisers, people who hoard information.
Ooh, that would be Cora. You don't know Cora. I've been around for 20 years. Boy, does she hold on to information. Held on to listings, held on to everything.
A lot of people tell me, that's my boss, they'll say. That's someone I work with, a colleague. A lot of people like to hoard information and not share it when that really undermines them. And then there are the info-voiders, people who shun information that could help them to avoid a blunder, but they don't want to hear it. They don't want to be exposed to it. Information contrary to what the person wants to hear or believes, or it's coming from a source that we don't like, and therefore we want to dismiss it.
Between the info misers and the info voiders, you give a lot of examples, but I was surprised to hear that that Saddam Hussein was an infomaniac.
An infomaniac extraordinaire, I'd say. It was so intense that his own commanders in the military could not communicate with each other. Saddam was so paranoid, he didn't want anyone to be working against him behind his back. And so there are stories now of commanders who had to run reconnaissance over their own battlefield just to find out what their other divisions, their other troops were doing.
Their own troops.
Their own troops, that's right. So they were so poorly coordinated because they were not allowed to share information.
So not only did he hold on to his own information, he didn't want anybody else having any information ever.
That's exactly right. I ask one question in all of my work, my previous books, all of my writing as an academic. It's all been geared toward trying to understand this one question. Why is it that we shoot ourselves in the foot, like Saddam did, or like Thomas Alva Edison did? I want to know why we all sometimes undermine ourselves, and specifically in this book, why individuals, businesses, organizations, and even whole nations sometimes sabotage their own success. Unlike a psychologist or behavioral economist or any other social scientist, they try to create carefully controlled experiments to help us understand how we think and why we might undermine ourselves or make bad decisions. And I approach this question from a totally different perspective, that of a historian. That's my training. And so when a historian looks at these questions of how we think and how we make judgments, he takes a completely different approach, whereas the social scientist tries to isolate variables and create experiments that will be carefully controlled. A historian doesn't have that luxury. Instead, we have to look at the myriad variables that people confront every day, and not just look at what the documents tell us, but everything that was going on in that decision maker's life. So, for example, what was it like to go to work each day? What was this person's relationship to his or her boss, the colleagues? What was happening in the home life? What was happening in the economy at that time, the more macro-level questions? What was happening in the organization they were in? What was happening in international affairs? Whatever might have affected that particular decision maker. So these are really tough questions to answer, but historians confront all of these different variables. And when we do, we're not asking what did people do when they were in the laboratory. Instead, we look at what they actually did in the real world.
I think a really interesting example of this is something you call exposure anxiety, fear of being seen as weak. Now, we've all seen examples of decisions come down in the workplace or in organizations we're in for whatever reason and say, why in heaven's name would they ever have made that decision? And that's when you look at those things in your life that sort of blindsided you or upset you or totally took you off in another direction and weren't quite comprehensible, that's the point at which you really can now start to look backwards.
You absolutely got it, Moira. This is what I'm trying to do, is show how we can make these connections across all the levels, from the international level, the organizational level, down to our individual lives. And the historian's approach is completely different. We look at the end and work backward and see how we got there. We don't try to predict necessarily what people will do. We look at how they actually behaved. And when we do that, we start seeing things like exposure anxiety. Many people pick up on this and they say, that's my boss. That's another case, along with infomania. It's the one they like to feel they can relate to the most. Because people often, in positions of power, are afraid to have anyone see them as flawed, right? And when that happens, they tend to reinforce failure rather than work towards success. Instead of saying, okay, I clearly got us off on the wrong track here. Let's backtrack and start again and figure out how we can do this better. What happens more often is the people in positions of power don't want to be seen as flawed, and they get committed to the wrong path they started out on. And insisting that they've always been right, they just keep making matters worse. That's what leads to blunders.
One insight that I took away is that for men who have this fear of being seen as weak, we experience them as usually trying to appear supremely confident, whereas women with this fear of being seen as weak, they either act very tough or they present themselves as cool and quiet. I was really kind of shocked about that. The men I could kind of see, but the women, they were kind of flying under my radar, frankly.
It's true. We've had cases of many female world leaders, and often they take on a persona of greater toughness than the men around them. You could think of the Iron Lady.
You want tough? I'll give you tough. Yeah.
Exactly. Margaret Thatcher and so on. Right. And I think that's unfortunate because it undermines one of the great strengths that women can bring to leadership. And that is an ability to say, you know what, let's take a softer approach when that's appropriate. We don't have to be super tough all the time. Exposure anxiety shows how people will respond to this fear of being seen as weak or flawed with excessive force, when moderate force might be more appropriate, or diplomacy.
But the cool and quiet ones, that's the one that really kind of blew me away. You don't usually pay attention to them.
That's true. Those people often come across as shy or detached. And really, I'm drawing on the work of the psychologist, I believe his name is Michael McKay, a San Francisco-based psychologist. And he points this out. He's done work for, I think, 30 years with clinical counseling. And this is one of the personality types he's identified.
You've got a whole selection here, but I think there's a few that really ring true today because we so want one solution to fit everything. And of course, I'm talking about cure-allism, one size fits all.
When you look at our current financial crisis, you can see a clear example of cure-allism. This is that idea that you take a theory that works well in one place, and then you apply it to places it never belonged. And one example I give in the book is about free marketism, just this idea that markets can solve all problems. And I think now, in the wake of this current financial crisis, we can see how bankrupt that philosophy is, literally. The idea of deregulation and no oversight, stripping away regulation, has undermined our strength as a nation.
And globalization, for instance, this flat view, seeing the world in one dimension, I mean, it's hard to argue that globalization leads to prosperity when now one in six people in the world live in a slum. And that's a pretty recent statistic that used to be much fewer.
Correct. I think the problem in the globalization debate is exactly this flat view concept. This is one of the cognition traps. I say flat view is seeing the world in one dimension, in binary mode, so that you're either with us or against us. You're either a communist or a capitalist in one camp or the other. It's not very helpful in a complex world when you reduce everything down to these simple on-off measures. In globalization, we tend to talk about it as either a net good or a net bad, when in reality, globalization is both good and bad at different times in different places for different people.
And while there's many examples and many cognition traps leading to blunders, we can't get out of here without talking about cause fusion, confusing the causes of complex events. And of course, Jerome Groopman has been on the show many times and even on the show talking about the misdiagnosis of his wrist. This is a great example because everybody goes to the doctor and everybody gets a lot of the same standard advice.
Jerome Groopman wrote a book called How Doctors Think, and he tells in it the story of his wrist. He had some wrist problem, shooting pains up his arm, and every doctor he went to immediately diagnosed the problem, but misdiagnosed it, because they didn't really take the time to think about him as an individual and to examine him carefully. They came with lots of preconceptions, and they fell into a lot of cognition traps, the main one being cause fusion. It wasn't until Groopman went to a younger doctor who was much more open-minded, sat down with him, and examined both his wrists, the healthy one and the damaged one, and thought more carefully about what was different between the two. And he spent a lot more time listening to Groopman tell his story of how he damaged the wrist, whereas the other doctors had been more dismissive, assuming that they knew already what the problem was. And through that process, they were able to find out the true cause of the damage to his wrist. What that story showed to me, something critically important and a theme that comes through the book in all of the stories I tell, and there may be 100 different anecdotes throughout this blunder book about people who fell into cognition traps and led to blunders because they lacked two things, empathy and imagination. They just didn't exercise those things enough. In Groopman's case, the doctor had the empathy to put himself in Groopman's mind and body and try to think about what was really happening to him, what was unique. And he had the imagination to come up with new ways of thinking about the problem so they could get at the root cause.
And what did they do?
Well, after they did a serious comparison, then he was able to find what was really causing the shooting pains and go in with some simple surgery and correct it, solve the problem perfectly.
And what they actually did was they x-rayed both wrists so that they could get the picture of the two in comparison. I mean, whoever went in and had the other limb x-rayed, when you said, it hurts here, doc, you know, but that's what it finally took.
It took a control, actually, a control, which is part and parcel of the scientific method. You would think, really, anyone should be doing this, looking at a control group, a control experiment. But
and hey, there's one on your body.
Right. Cause fusion is so prevalent in all our lives, but especially in the medical field. And I give a lot of examples of that, from the way we deal with back pain and depression to schizophrenia and much more. I also have an interesting tech example. A friend of mine, Francis Kelly, was working with me on the early drafts of this book, some of the chapters. And when I showed him the cause fusion chapter, he immediately told me that he wished he had read it the day before. Francis is a co-founder of a San Francisco-based company called Lumia, and they do recommendation software. So when you go onto Amazon, it says, people who enjoyed this book also enjoyed these others. That's the type of software they write. And on that day at his company, they had a problem, the details of which are not important, but they identified a particular problem and its cause and spent a few hours trying to figure out how to fix this problem. Only later did they realize that what they had identified as the cause wasn't at all related to the problem. It was related, but it was not the real root cause of the problem. And once they stepped back from that, they were able to think about what other things might be causing this problem, identify it, and then solve it. And he says since then, they've now taken the book and they're able to run essentially a cognition trap checklist. To go down this list of cognition traps, I outline and say, what can we do differently? How can we approach problem solving in a different way and make sure that we're not falling into these cognition traps?
Well, you'd be missing a real treat if you thought that this was just about modern day, what goes on and what might be applied to these blunders. You go back and give us a lot of ancient history. Give us an example of some of your stories.
One of the ones I give is from early 19th century Southeast Asia. I compare Thailand and Vietnam and how those different leaders dealt with information and how that contributed to the colonization of Vietnam by the French and the independence of Thailand, how the Thai leaders, Kings Mongkut and Chulalongkorn, were able to learn as much as they could. They were not info voiders. They were open to information. They wanted to learn as much as they could about the British and the Europeans and then use that information to avoid being colonized. The Vietnamese, Nguyen dynasty, on the other hand, they were closed to learning about the Europeans. And as a result, that lack of information contributed to their colonization. Obviously, that's not the only factor, but I think it was one major factor. That openness to information is really critical. What Mongkut and Chulalongkorn were able to do was to use their knowledge of British customs to make the British feel at home and give them all the ceremonial respect. There's a wonderful passage in the book that cites from the records of John Bowring, the British emissary to Thailand at the time, Siam. And he writes all about the elaborate measures that the king took to make them feel welcomed. And he sees all the signs of British technology, the clocks, the portraits of the British king and queen, and he's extremely impressed. So Mongkut really uses his knowledge of the Westerners to their advantage. One other point I really want to make, Moira, is that we often hear people say that too much information is a dangerous thing. I read this a lot, I see this a lot in many contexts, people saying, you know, it's too overwhelming when you get too much information, and so we have to reduce everything down to bite-sized bits. I think that's a mistake. I think that the quantity of information is irrelevant. It's the relevance of any quantity that matters. If we can get the right information, even if it's a lot, that's much better than trying to reduce things down to the bare minimum.
Well, Zach, thank you so much for joining me. Please come back and see us again.
It was absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
My guest today is Zachary Shore. The book is Blunder: Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions. It's published by Bloomsbury. More information about this interview is available at www.technation.com. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
You've been listening to the Gigavox Media podcast edition of Tech Nation with Dr. Moira Gunn. Most editions of Tech Nation are recorded at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation is also available on over 200 public radio stations throughout the United States, as well as Armed Forces Radio. Please check your local listings for time and availability. The post-production audio engineer for this program was Paul Figiani. My name is Doug Kay, and I hope you'll join me next time for another edition of Tech Nation here on the Conversations Network.